let me tell you about Ahab, the Arab, the sheik of the burning sands. He had emeralds and rubies just a dripping off of him, and a ring on every finger of his hand. He wore a big old turban wrapped around his head and a scimitar by his side. And every evening about midnight, he'd jump on his camel named Clyde and ride silently through the night to the Sultan's tent, where he would secretly meet up with Fatima of the Seven Veils, the swingin'est number one dancer in the Sultan's whole harem. Cause like him and her had a thing going, you know, and they'd been carrying on for some time now behind the Sultan's back. And you could hear him talk to his camel as he rode out across the dunes. His voice would cut through the still night desert air, and he'd say, oh, yeah, 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 oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Put your there and make foot. Whoa, babies! And Clyde say, well, he brought his camel to a screeching halt in the rear of Fatima's tent. Jumped off Clyde, snuck around the corner and into the tent he went. There he saw Fatima laying on a zebra skin rug, with rings on her fingers and bells on her toes and a bone in her nose, ho, ho. There she was, friends and neighbors laying there in all her radiant beauty, eating on a raisin and a grape and an apricot and a pomegranate, a bowl of chitterlings, two bananas, three Hershey bars, and sipping on an ROC Coca, listening to her transistor, watching the Grand Ole Opry, and reading Mad Magazine while she sung, "Does your chewing gum lose its flavor?" And Ahab walk up to her and he say, oh, yeah, 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 oh, 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 yeah. Which is Aramic for, let's twist again like we did last summer, babies. And she say, crazy baby. All of a sudden the Sultan walked in. Ahab knew that this was the end. Him and Fatima was caught by surprise, and the Sultan had fire flashing out of his eyes. Well, the Sultan charged at Ahab, intending to make a dent in his head. But he fled with Fatima, and out of the tent they went. They jumped on Clyde and started to ride, cutting out across the sand, with the Sultan's whole army in hot pursuit. On and on they ran. Well, to make the long story short, they got away, cause there wasn't no animal alive what could keep up with Clyde once he got started, cause he would have swept his feet on the old desert babies. And they made it across the border where Ahab hopped all his rubies and emeralds, and the bottom was swinging little split-level pad, and lived happy ever after. Yeah, and that's the story about Ahab, the Arab, the sheik of the burning sand.
And if you wanted old Clive to go into overdrive, you had to have two bricks to slam together in his rear back there, and I ain't going to say what. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana, just like always. In the bunker. Yeah, beautiful day today. Sunshine of the day. Fairly warm. I think it's going to get up in the 40s at least today. Yeah, no snow, no rain, but it's coming. It's coming, boys and girls. It is the 23rd. Right? Yeah, the 23rd of February, 2016, and we got some birthdays to talk about here. Well, we got to apologize to the creator of the Church of What's Happening Now, Ben Klassen. Yeah, our buddy Ben Klassen, who's been dead for quite a while now, but he was a good man, and he did some good work, and he wrote about five books, and one of them he got mad at me, but we won't talk about that, but... Anyhow, Nature's Eternal Religion and White Man's Bible, if you haven't read them, get them and read them. Yeah, they're still available. Right-wing Christ Insanity people didn't like Ben. No, they badmouthed him all the time. And then one fat fart out there in the West Coast now, he dreamed up all kinds of terrible things to say about Ben Klassen. But Ben Klassen was a stand-up guy. He invested his fortune in the white race and did everything he could. His birthday was on the 20th. Well, I guess that was it for this week. Ben Klassen, yeah. Now let's go on here and see what's cooking. Let's see what's cooking with the wild and woolly, crazy, Christ insanity world. I was going to play a couple of songs I sang over Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, but the CDs, karaoke CDs are screwed up. Man, I've got some scratched up CDs. It's a lot of them I'm going to have to throw away. But now everything's becoming electronic. You can get it right off the web without any CDs. So we may try that. Well, this guy was driving one of these Uber, I think it's an Uber car up in Michigan that went down the freeway or something and shot 9 people. I guess he killed about all of them. He's a white boy. I'd like to know whether he served in the Middle East. That's very important information. I haven't been able to dig it out yet, and the fact that I haven't been able to dig it out makes me suspicious, because it sounds one of these guys that was contaminated with depleted uranium poisoning out of some of that ammo and the burning in those ammo dumps over there in the Middle East. There are going to be a lot of those kind of things. A lot of these guys are infected with that depleted uranium, and they can go off at any time. There's been some that have killed their whole families. So if anybody hears about whether this guy was a veteran of the Middle East, let me know.
Bye-bye. Look, see, he's smiling. See, he's having a good time. Oh, I love the old days, you know? You know what I hate? There's a guy totally disruptive, throwing punches. We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks. That's true. You know, I love our police, and I really respect our police, and they're not getting enough. They're not. But honestly, I hate to see that. Here's a guy throwing punches, nasty as hell, screaming at everything else when we're talking. And he's walking out, and we're not allowed, you know, the guards are very gentle with him. He's walking out like big high fives, smiling, laughing, like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
Well, that's the kind of stuff they like to hear. I don't blame them. They like raw meat, raw meat. The Trumpites love it. And I like it, too. But I'm not a great fan of Mr. Trump because he's a billionaire, and I don't trust any billionaires. He's part of the ruling class. Okay. But what he said there, I agree with. You know, I've mentioned this Joe Madison, this Negro talk show guy. And, he's pretty funny. And what's so funny is he takes himself so seriously, like he's so smart. And he is. He's pretty smart. But he just gives those blacks, almost all blacks call in on his show. He just gives them holy hell. If they don't start out and say just what he thinks they ought to say, he jumps all over them, worse than a Nazi would jump on them. I get a kick, and so in the morning a lot of times I'll listen to, you know, maybe 15 minutes or while I'm brushing my teeth or something, and it's funny as hell. Well, I got to where every once in a while I Twitter him, and he's had a number of Indiana Negroes calling in, so I Twittered him and said, Joe, you might want to tell those Indiana people that they're my neighbors back here in Indiana. and if they need any therapy, give me a call. If you want to hear a Negro giving Negroes hell, the whites won't do it, but the Negroes will. Joe Madison, look him up.
In Argentina right now.
Well, it's Republicans versus...
The book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. So what is the situation in Argentina right now?
Well, it's Republicans versus Democrats, and I don't mean Argentine Republicans and Democrats. You have really hidden in this story about Argentina which is all over the papers, like, why do we care about Argentina other than World Cup? You know, they blew it. That's it. The answer is that, in fact, what's happening in Argentina may determine the United States presidential election in 2016 because of the players and what's on the table, which most Americans don't understand. Attacking Argentina is the number one New York donor to the Republican Party and the most influential donor, Paul the Vulture Singer. I didn't give him the name the Vulture. I think his mother did, but certainly he's known as the Vulture by bankers because he's a guy who attacks the weak and the dying. I've hunted this guy, you know, from the Congo to Peru to Argentina for The Guardian and others. And he waits in ambush. In the case of Argentina, taking some very bad advice from the IMF, decided that it could only survive by defaulting. This was about 15 years ago. It restructured its debts. This cost the United States taxpayer at the time a pretty penny to resolve Argentina's debts, or so we thought. So you and I, through the IMF, 50% of the IMF's debts belong to the United States. We helped restore Argentina, which became actually a very strong economy until this latest attack by Singer, who said, wait a minute, 15 years ago, those bonds you defaulted, I kept 3% of them. And now I want you to pay me. Are you ready for this, Tom? He paid about $30 million. He wants $3 billion. That's 100 times what he pays. He's not asking Argentina to pay off old debts. Argentina said, we will pay you what the face value of the bonds. Everyone else took short money. We'll give you 100%. That's not good enough for Singer. He wants 100 times what he paid. If that happens, Argentina goes down, but so do the big banks out of New York, Citibank, J.P. Morgan, and in Europe, the United Bank of Switzerland, which put together the original deal. Those banks will then, if Argentina goes into default, those banks end up in huge financial trouble. He has sued. So the billionaire Republican hotshot, Paul Singer, the Vulture, has not only sued Argentina, he sued J.P. Morgan, Citibank, United Bank of Switzerland, and said, whatever money Argentina gave you over the years, baby, that's mine. And those banks, and by the way, he's actually stopped Argentina. He got a court order which prevents Argentina from paying off its debts unless he gets his pound, or in his case, his ton of flesh.
What possible legal rationale does he have for this?
It's a berserko, a complete berserko legal rationale. And by the way, I want you to know that the reason Paul Singer's gone into a U.S. court, that's because, after some of my reports, he is barred from using any court in Britain or the Commonwealth. He's barred from China. He's barred from Europe. So he goes into U.S. court and finds an old Nixon appointee, 84 years old, okay? And I'm going to be straight about it. The Constitution doesn't allow us to retire these brain melts. And talks this guy, the legal theory is that no bondholder can be paid unless everyone's paid. Fine. Argentina's offered the same deal to the Vulture as every other bank, including 100% payoff. He won't accept it, and he's been able to actually stop payments to the rest of the world's big banks. This is a problem for you and me. Whether we like it or not, we have bailed out these banks. We uphold their reserves. If Argentina goes down, their reserves are in real trouble, these big central banks, and it breaks up it attacks all deals, whether it's Argentina, whether the deal we just had in Greece. He's going after Spain now. He took $165 million out of the Greek treasury when they were bankrupt. And he even took, and this is a story I did, he took away the money we sent to the Congo Republic to clean the water systems to end a cholera epidemic. He took that money for some old Civil War debts from, like, that no one even knows if they're legit. But he basically took the foreign aid money we gave to the Congo Republic to cure a cholera epidemic. He's a really sweet guy. This is the guy, and again, I want to emphasize, and this is not small, he's a crucial Republican donor, and the big banks, of course, have been backing Obama and Clinton. So you see here, not only a difference in donors, but a difference in philosophy. The big banks think that government does ultimately have some role in controlling the financial system,
Greg,
and banning these outlaws.
There's a conspiracy theory, shall we say, among some in Democratic circles, that the Republicans, one of the reasons that they've been obstructing so many efforts by President Obama to put the economy back together, extend long-term unemployment, rebuild roads, anything that might stimulate the economy, is because they actually want the economy to crash because there's two more years left in the Obama presidency, and they want it to look like Herbert Hoover's last 2 years so that they can have an entire generation of Republicans the way that Herbert Hoover led to a generation of Democrats. I'm curious your thoughts on that conspiracy theory, and B, could Singer taking down big American banks with this lawsuit be the tip of the spear of that? You wrote, in Europe, Singer's a financial outlaw, but in the USA, he's a job creator. It seems,
Let's go beyond to the facts of one of the things he's done. One, he's had another target, which is the United States Treasury. He's demanding $3 billion of Argentina. You should know that he and his partners took $12 billion from the U.S. Treasury during the auto bailout. He silently, secretly, and through some flim-flam, got a hold of the GM auto parts division and said he would shut down the auto parts operation. GM was already in bankruptcy. GM would have been liquidated. We'd have lost 100,000 jobs easy, 100,000 jobs. Unless he got $12 billion. He got the check because GM said they couldn't operate for another 24 hours without those parts. He literally cut off GM's parts.
Amazing.
And got
so
$12
just
billion.
Have 20 seconds left, Greg. You think he could take down the banks and cause a big crash?
He would love it. He calls it creative destruction. I see a lot of destruction, not the creation.
Yeah.
This is 2016 being played out in another continent.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Greg Palast, and I realized the chapter.
Well, what did I tell you? Follow the money. Follow the money. And how come these stories aren't in the regular press? And how come these stories aren't talked about on these conservative right-wing radio shows? They yap all the time about abortion and apple pie and how many troops we're going to send to the Middle East and how we got to feed all the people in Africa. But they don't talk about this kind of stuff. And this is why we have to dig for it. And that's what I'll continue to do. I want you to remember, all militias are equal, but some are more equal than others. Yeah.
An out-of-work Iraqi politician who leads a 4,000-man private militia is deepening his ties to Washington in an attempt to remake the Obama administration's foreign policy toward Iraq. Adil al-Nujafi, who was booted out of office as governor of Iraq's northern Nineveh province last year, in February signed a six-month, $90,000 contract with a lobbyist to represent the Sunni militia that he controls. Nujafi says the militia known as the National Mobilization Force represents the best available opportunity to drive the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, out of the Iraqi city of Mosul. Everybody says that there are no Sunni fighters ready to fight in Iraq. Well, that's a lie, said Robert Kelly, the lawyer who signed on to lobby for Nujafi's National Mobilization Force. Kelly spent 2 years as a staffer at the United States Embassy in Baghdad and also previously worked on Capitol Hill. The governor has 4,000 fighters right outside of Mosul. The contract is just the latest example of Sunni leaders turning to K Street to win over hearts and minds in Washington amid skepticism that the central government in Baghdad can overcome sectarian divisions and fight ISIS. Like other Sunni leaders, Nujafi is pushing the United States to shift its focus away from the Iraqi government and toward regional and tribal leaders throughout the country. They're using the anti-ISIS fight as a means with which to strengthen their argument, said Aaron Stein, a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. The strategy builds on the widespread belief here in town that the only way to defeat ISIS is to raise a Sunni force, Stein added, and the only thing that's stopping the raising of the Sunni force is sectarianism and Shia governance in Baghdad that's not helping them. Deep sectarian divisions have stunted Iraq's growth in the years since the U.S.-led coalition forced Saddam Hussein from power in 2003. Many in the country's minority Sunni population claim that they have been abandoned by the central government in Baghdad, which has grown closer to Shiite-led Iran. That split, and what critics decry as ineffective bureaucracy in Baghdad, has led to a power vacuum in which ISIS can thrive. Islamic State is a symptom. It is not a cause, said Ryan Crocker, a former the United States ambassador to Iraq and Afghanistan, at an event hosted by the Atlantic Council last week. A lot of the residents in Mosul, you know, looked askance at Baghdad, looked askance at the Kurdish region, and that gave them just enough of a crevice to hang on, he added. Well, those crevices have now become canyons. Some Sunni Iraqis, claiming that Baghdad has been deaf to their pleas, have gone straight to Washington for help. Hiring lobbyists is a direct statement on what we would call the mainstream Iraqi Sunni perspective that they can't work with Baghdad, said Nicholas Hiraz, a research associate in the Center for a New American Security's Middle East Security Program. Nujafi previously paid a consultant firm $300,000 over 3 months of work in 2014, and made a blitz through the Washington's major foreign policy circles last year. He isn't alone. A handful of Sunni tribal leaders have also attempted to make inroads into the United States by hiring K Street firms to push their message. But Nujafi's effort is especially notable, given his history in government and the fact that his brother, Osama, is Iraq's former vice president and parliament speaker. They're like the Bushes of Mosul, said Michael Knights, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Osama is George Bush and Adil Nujafi is Jeb Bush. Nujafi wants assistance from the United States to go after ISIS, which took control of Mosul in 2014, months before Nujafi was booted from office. Intransigence has clogged the gears in Baghdad, Nujafi insists, so Washington needs to step in. In essence, Nujafi's plan is for a redux of the Sunni awakening of 2006 and 2007, when Sunni Iraqis largely in Anbar province switched sides to fight alongside the United States. Outside forces will not be supported by the people of Mosul, Nujafi wrote in a January letter to Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman John McCain, Arizona. National mobilization fighters, he added, are from Mosul and the surrounding Nineveh province and are crucial to the liberation of Mosul. But the fight against ISIS is just a means to an end, he has made clear. You may ask what is our vision after liberation? Nujafi asked in a speech at the Brookings Institution last spring. We need autonomy as a part of a strong federal Iraq. The semi-autonomous Kurdistan regional government, which first hired Washington lobbyists in 2006, should be a model for his people, he added. They can solve their problems inside their autonomy, he said. I think we can solve our problems. To some extent, the narrative has taken root. In a speech outlining her plan to fight ISIS last year, Hillary Clinton called for the United States to lay the foundation for a second Sunni awakening. Marco Rubio's presidential campaign calls for Baghdad to increase Sunni inclusion and autonomy for the provinces, and to provide arms directly to Sunni tribal and Kurdish forces if Baghdad fails to support them. Perhaps most importantly, this year's defense policy law allows the administration to provide arms to Sunni forces and Kurdish Peshmerga if it determines that the government in Baghdad hasn't done enough to unify the country and integrate minority groups. The law ordered the Obama administration to file a report on whether Baghdad has met its goals by March 24. Despite the apparent gains by Sunnis, Critics say the Obama administration has been slow to meet the moment. The Obama White House and the State Department are completely supportive of the government in Baghdad, said Kelly, the foreign lobbyist. So the result is that there is no support for the fighters that the governor has right outside Mosul. Not everyone is as confident in the effort. While Nujafi and others claim to support a unified Iraq, albeit with a more pronounced federalism, some worry that the effort is purely a vanity project that will only split the country into pieces. To me, it just looks like somebody who got booted out of office trying to use their money and foreign connections to make themselves relevant in the future, said Knights. The only people who are really getting any benefit out of this are the lobbyists themselves.
Had a couple of problems in that recording, but the main reason I'm playing this for you is how stupid it is that these idiots in Washington, many of them have only been in Washington, you know, a couple of years, but this Hillary and all that, trying to run this shit in the Middle East. It's too complicated for anybody. There are too many factions, too much. Can you imagine Hillary and these other jerks trying to handle all this tribal shit? It's insane. They don't know their ass from a hole in the ground. They're just playing it by ear. The only way to solve it is to get out. Get the fuck out. Actually, the pessimist guide to history makes more sense than this stuff. 1815, Indonesian volcano explodes. Until April 15, 1815, the Indonesian volcano Tambora had been thought to be extinct, and soldiers at the British forts in Indonesia mistook the volcano's first deep rumblings for distant cannon fire. Soon, however, it became clear Tambora had come to life. Great volumes of ash spewed out over the 13,000-foot peak and plunged the area into utter darkness for days. Then on April 11th, the volcano exploded and spewed out some 36 cubic miles of ejecta, the largest volume in history. The blast also created a tremendous whirlwind that sucked up people, livestock, and houses. Meanwhile, a tidal wave slammed into the coastal areas, adding to the destruction. When the cataclysmic eruption was finally over, Tambora had blown away 4,000 feet of its cone, and some 12,000 people living around the volcano had been killed. Ash from the volcano wiped out crops in the surrounding area, causing famine. An estimated 82,000 people later died of starvation and disease. This eruption is believed to have been caused the infamous year without a summer of 1816. When unusually cold weather brought famine to North America and Europe. Never, never trust a sleeping volcano or an extinct one. 1816, year without a summer. On the morning of June 6th, snow began falling in northeastern United States. The snowfall amounted to 20 inches in some places, with flakes as large as 2 inches across. The blizzard and killing frost that persisted for 5 days ruined crops, forced farmers to plow fields under and replant. But in July, again in August, and yet again in September, the snow and the frost returned. I guess that's climate change. No one could understand what one diarist called the most gloomy and extraordinary weather ever seen, in which snowfalls, color red, blue, and brown, had fallen, and the sky was obscured by a dusty haze. The only thing certain was that crops had failed miserably, and hunger and famine loomed ahead. By winter, people grubbing for wild onions and ate pigeons and groundhogs to survive. Meanwhile, all across Europe, the cold weather devastated crops. In the Loire Valley of France, rioting mobs, furious at the excessively high prices of grain, attacked grain carts on the way to the market. In East Anglia, England, citizens brandished sticks and iron spikes and carrying the banners that read "Bread or Blood," looted and vandalized their way through several towns. In Dundee, Scotland, a grain dealer's home was looted and burnt by the frenzied mob. By the spring of 1817, people in Switzerland were reduced to catching stray cats for food. Sickness and fever accompanied the starvation. And in Ireland, an estimated 50,000 people eventually died as a result of typhus epidemic precipitated by the harsh famine. It was not until 1920 that the unusual weather was linked to the 1815 eruption of Mount Tambora, a volcano on the other side of the world in Java. Scientists concluded that the volcano blasted up into the stratosphere huge quantities of fine dust particles, which remained suspended there for years and reduced the amount of warming sunlight able to reach the Earth's surface, the opposite of the greenhouse effect. We are forever at the mercy of untamed Mother Nature. 1819, earthquakes in Italy kills 20,000. The cities of Genoa and Palermo, Italy, were demolished by a massive quake in late August. Thousands of people were buried in the rubble of collapsed buildings. 1820, Manila Massacre, a mob of native Filipinos, which at one point reached 10,000 to 15,000 in number, went on a bloody rampage in Manila from March 9th to 11th. Apparently incited to riot by the Spanish, the Filipinos attacked and brutally murdered about 125 foreigners before the mob was dispersed. 1822, Aleppo earthquake. A violent earthquake lasted for 10 to 12 seconds, struck the Syrian cities of Aleppo and Antioch and their surrounding areas at 9:30 p.m. on August 10th. Many houses and large buildings collapsed, crushing or trapping the terrified occupants. This is probably worse than all this bombing we're doing now in Aleppo. The deadly tremors devastated a third of the villages and cities in Syria. In all, some 20,000 people died and an equal number injured. Survivors were further terrified by continuing aftershocks that occurred the next 2 months. By then, countless thousands of villages and farmers faced the grim prospect of winter's onset without homes or sufficient shelter. So, Syrian people have been through this crap before. That's the end of our pessimist history for today. So you should feel lucky. This is to make you feel good. Yeah, listen to this stuff make you feel damn good. What makes you feel a little bad is anything like this can happen at any moment, anywhere in the world. You never know. So hope that the Tambora volcano don't blow up again, or one like it. Then you'd really have weather change.
I was thumbing from Montgomery. I had my guitar on my back. When a stranger stopped beside me in an antique Cadillac. He was dressed like 1950, half drunk and hollow-eyed. He said, "It's a long walk to Nashville. Would you like to ride?" I sat down in the front seat. Turned on the radio, and them sad old songs coming out of them speakers was solid country gold. Then I noticed the stranger was ghost white there when he asked me for a light, and I knew there was something strange about this ride. He said, "Drifter, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you moan the blues? Can you bend down?" He said, "Boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? 'Cause if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, long ride." Then he cried just south of Nashville, and he turned that car around. He said, "This is where you get off, boy. I'm going back to Alabama. As I stepped out of that Cadillac, I said, Mister, many thanks. He said, you don't have to call me Mister, Mister. The whole world called me Hank. He said, Ripper, can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you mow on the blues? Can you bend down guitar string? He said, boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? But if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride. But can you make folks cry when you play and sing? Have you paid your dues? Can you mow on the blues? Can you up and down your car string? He said, boy, can you make folks feel what you feel inside? Well, if you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride. If you're big star bound, let me warn you, it's a long, hard ride.
Now, I've spoken to you a few times about Aryan socialism, a little bit, and the need for it, and the need to go away from predatory capitalism. That capitalism is not good for the race. It's only good for the ruling class. So this was an article written by Major Donald Clerken, who I knew several years ago. He's passed away. And this was from June 1990 in Liberty Bell magazine. Quote, of this economic stoicism of the classical world, the exact antithesis is socialism, meaning thereby not Marxist theory, but Frederick William I's Prussian practice, which long preceded Marx and will yet displace him. The socialism inwardly akin to the system of old Egypt, that comprehends and cares for permanent economic relations, trains the individual in his duty to the whole, and glorifies hard work as an affirmation of time and future. And that's a quote from Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, Volume 1, page 138. Quote, men are tired to disgust of money economy. They hope for salvation from somewhere or other, for some real thing of honor and chivalry, of inward nobility, of unselfishness and duty. And now dawns the time when form-filled powers of the blood, which the rationalism of the megalopolis has suppressed, reawakened in the depths. Everything in the order of dynastic tradition and old nobility that has saved itself up for the future, everything that there is of high money disdaining ethic, everything that is intrinsically sound enough to be, in Frederick the Great's words, the servant, the hard-working, self-sacrificing, caring servant of the state, all that I have described in one word as socialism, in contrast to capitalism, all this becomes suddenly the focus of immense life forces, and that's Spengler, Volume 2, page 464. We Aryans realize the age of capitalism and its stooge democracy is just about over. The Western culture has evolved into the megalopolitan civilization. We are beset by political parties, press, and media. The parties in the pocket of the Jewish money, the press and the media, and the mouthpieces of Jewish money. Jewish money talks and rules in American society today. At this juncture, it is inevitable that the Caesarian will crush the sham democracy, which is permitted to the masses by the money power in order to organize them into easily fleeced tax herds. The masses have no choice. So locked into the system are they with the greed for monetary gain, but to play the game of phony elections and politics of voting for Tweedledee candidates who espouse disastrous policies. and who tell the sort of lies that the masses prefer to hear. Down this road, the masses will travel just once. Caesarism waits at the end, which for the Roman proletariat meant bread and circuses, but which for the white men of this of this age will mean mongrelization in the one-world corporate system. There's nothing honorable in being forced to join an anti-ant heap. Those who rule the megalopolis see no need for separate races and divergent cultures. Exploit and extirpate. These will be the motives of the new Caesars. But the Aryan does not have to share this fate. He can throw off the cult of money and greed for gain. Money has become an idol, the sole reason for existence of all too many Aryans. Children are either not begot or quickly thrown aside for the parents by the parents in pursuit of things. The state has become the symbol of this greed, causing millions of non-white unwashed to come to these shores seeking enrichment. When the Aryan racial state, the National Socialist Government of Germany, existed, the world's unwashed did not seek asylum there. It was understood that the NS-Staat existed for the building up of the Aryan race and not for the exploitation by the world of finance. Wherever money and finance rule, the state appears to the crows, gulls, and vultures like a great stinking landfill, where the caring servant of the Aryan people is the shepherd who guides the state. There are permitted no opportunities for parasites to feed off the lifeblood of the Aryan race. This is the Aryan socialism we support. It had nothing to do with money or phony party politics. Neither is it an ideology which Marx, Engels, and Lenin made of what they called socialism. Aryan socialism is a racial ethic, a soul force. Marxism is Jewish exploitation of the frustration the people feel against capitalism, also a Jewish motive, so as to get the wealth of the state and the people's lives into the Jewish hands. Jewish capitalism robs the people. Then the Jewish Marxists come in and enslave them. It is not true socialism. True socialism existed long before Marx in the soul of the Gothic Europe. It was the underlying motive behind the old regimes, that series of European governances which held sway before the Jewish Revolution against the French in 1789. Emancipated the power and authority of usury, the prime tool of the Jewish exploitation. The socialism we see as Aryan caring is first and foremost thoughtful of the Aryan race. It exists to nurture and protect, not to exploit, but to raise up. Call it Aryan racialism, if you prefer. It is the racial glue which binds the Aryan race together. The Jew gave the Aryans the idol of money to worship, which brought on an orgy of atomism, every man for himself. Aryan socialism once again ties the race together, forbidding the exploitation of our people and punishing racial treason committed against the Aryan race. In Aryan socialism, no Aryan need fear of the loss of property rights or individual immunities against the government persecution. Every other ism, capitalism, communism, conservatism, liberalism, exists to either exploit the weaknesses of the Aryan or to use the non-white masses against the traditions, the Aryans, as a battering ram. Aryan socialism cares nothing at all for the masses of the world, neither seeking to exploit or eradicate them. But Aryan socialism will not permit the Aryan race to be humiliated and exterminated by the corporate Caesars. Neither will we permit the unwashed third world masses to engulf our lands. There will be a showdown between the forces of Aryan socialism and corporate Caesarism. Corporate Caesarism won the first round in 1945. The next round, the final showdown, will come when the Aryan movement has succeeded in mobilizing the Aryan race in its own defense. Look at Europe today. In Italy, immigrants are being told to get out. France's National Front, Marine Le Pen's party, is winning local elections and on an anti-immigration platform. White Canada is waking up to the threat of multiracialism and multiculturalism, is presenting to the future of an Aryan racial presence there. In Budapest, thousands of Hungarians demonstrated against the influence of the Jews in the Hungarian state television authority. The German Republicans are saying clearly that they have had all they want of trash refugees that have come in, while Bonn does nothing to stop it. Be sure that a unified Germany will put an end to this invasion of immigrants from the Third World. Well, he was mistaken there, wasn't he? He was mistaken there. We Aryans in the United States have a choice. We can continue to do nothing and see our children and grandchildren dragged down to the level of the people of Bangladesh, mixed in the racial crucible, and destroyed forever, or we can start right now to make our racial cause heard. Do not be afraid to be known as a white racist. Do proclaim your racial concerns loudly. This is what it means to be an Aryan socialist. Caring about the future of your race is what this fight is all about. I have always been of the opinion that all it would take to stop the Jews and their stooges in their tracks is enough whites to tell them to stop. Everywhere in Eastern Europe, the Jews are being indicted by the peoples. The old Marxist stooges do not dare oppose the rising tide of anti-Jewish sentiment. Even in the USSR, the Pomyat Society is able to speak right out against the Jews. They can do it because they dare to do it. But if whites in the USA refuse to speak out, they will continue to be humiliated and ruined as a people. And that was from the Talon magazine, small magazine that was printed by the European American Alliance out of Milwaukee. And that was Clerken, Major Donald Vincent Clerken, a very loyal and radical Aryan who's passed away some, it must be about at least 10 or 15 years now. I think he'd be very disappointed at what he sees now, thinking that things were starting to straighten up, but things got much, much worse. I'm not going to have time to read this whole article, I don't think, but it's one of my favorite, all-time favorite writers. That's Revelo P. Oliver, who was a professor over at Urbana College over in Illinois. He was an expert on languages, and he was a genius on politics and race, and he didn't back down to anything. Title of this article is When Abortion is a Crime. All simpletons know that there ain't no difference between the races, but nevertheless, female congoids commonly become pubert when they're 9 years old. A few years ago in Chicago, one specimen, perhaps a little precocious, being barely nine and in an advanced stage of pregnancy, was mentioned in the local press because she'd been raped by her uncle and had been taken to a hospital where she would be aborted. Immediately, a passel of men and women, all of the species that is so stupid that it permits itself to be taxed for the comfort of congoids and to accelerate their breeding, assembled outside the hospital to protest what they called a crime. They wailed that old Jesus had injected a soul into the precious fetus and destined it to grow up to afflict white boobs like themselves. Whether old Jesus had also incited the rape was not clear. Perhaps that question did not occur to their clotted minds. There is one instance in which a similar abortion would have been a crime against humanity. Whether it occurred or not, I unfortunately do not know. The Weekly World News is given to sensationalism, but unlike more respected newspapers, it never so far as is known, invents the stories it published. In its issue of 20 December, it stated a 15-year-old female congoid from Kenya was pregnant and would give birth normally in January, She said she'd been raped by a baboon. There was obviously something wrong with that story, because as everybody knows, male baboons having many activities to occupy their time and hold their interest become sexually aroused only when a female in oestrus presents herself to them and solicits fecundation. According to the obstetrician's report, however, there was ample proof that the child in the womb had been endangered by a baboon. He had a priori believed such an event impossible, because, as you know, baboons are not apes. They're not they are monkeys, and therefore farther removed from the human species, having diverged from the evolutionary line much earlier than the gorillas, orangutans, and chimpanzees. He was, however, convinced that the young woman was impregnated by a baboon. We're certain that the child in the womb is not entirely human. It has the facial features of a baboon and appears to be covered with thick mat of hair. Quote, God only knows, he added, how it will behave after it is born. The infant may be weak and helpless like a human, or it may swing from the chandeliers. Obviously, the infant was one that should properly arouse the solicitude of all intelligent persons, and the pregnant mother and her child, when born, deserved the utmost care, since it was a phenomenon that would provide crucial data about the genetics of anthropoids. There were suggestions of abortion, although an abortion in the eighth month of pregnancy would endanger the life of the mother. I do not know whether the nitwits who demonstrated in Chicago would have been certain that Jesus had been at work in Kenya, thus making the semi-baboon sacred as a future customer for holy men, but aborting it would have been a crime against mankind, preventing our race from obtaining scientific information of the utmost value on a crucial matter. Unfortunately, I do not know what happened in Nairobi, unless the reader who kindly sent me the article I have cited overlooked a subsequent item in the Weekly World News. There was no report in the American press, nor the New York Times and similar publications well know why American boobs should be allowed to learn that a female congoid can conceive a baboon by a baboon. Baboons, as I have said, are monkeys, and that is what made the pregnancy in Kenya so astonishing. It has long been believed that the human females could conceive by gorillas. One apparent hybrid named Julia Pastrana became quite famous in the middle of the 19th century. See the article by Alan Callahan in Liberty Bell, March 86. The author justly observes that although she exhibited human intelligence, the fact that her child, sired by the man who virtually owned her, closely resembled her, corroborates the opinion that she had been endangered by an ape. In January 1976, a similar creature, evidently part gorilla or orangutan, as shown by the published photograph, was purchased for $8,000 by an attorney in New York named Michael Miller, who thought it a capital investment from which he intended to profit. I do not know what happened. If any reader of these pages knows what was the result of the highly significant pregnancy in Kenya, I shall be greatly grateful for the information. The scandalous affair, this is building your future, going on to another subject. The scandalous affair of the Savings and Loan Associations, also known as the Building and Loan Associations, has received relatively little attention from its victims, the American taxpayers. Perhaps the world's beasts of burden are so used to their servitude and the yoke about their neck that they realize it would be futile to complain when they are goaded. There have, of course, been articles in the press more or less openly predicting that the worst is yet to come. The best that I have seen is in a periodical of wide circulation is a series of articles in Forbes magazine by Ashby Bladen, of which the first in the issue for 21 March 1988 shows that he clearly understood the political causes of the debacle, although he prudently refrained from tracing them to their source. The details of the malodorous fraud were set forth in an incisive article by Stephen Pizzo, Mary Fricker, and Paul Moilo, Inside Job, which appeared in Playboy magazine, presumably in the issue for December 1989, of which a kind correspondent has sent me photocopies. It describes the amazing audacious swindle carried out by unsavory individuals who are named and whose antecedents, criminal affiliations, and police records should have prevented even naive persons from entrusting them with so much as $1. Most significant in the blatant ostentation with which the thieves displayed their corruption, traveled in their own private jets, lived in conspicuously wasteful luxury, proudly displayed vulgar prodigality, and giving lavishly expensive parties at which they provided teams of highly talented whores for their guests. You may at first sight wonder why many individuals who witness the ostentatious spendthrift antics of the heads of the various savings and loan associations and knew from the press of some of their patently spurious investments did not immediately withdraw whatever funds they had entrusted to persons whose apollostic prosperity could not have been honestly attained. You will see the reason at once. They knew that no matter how much had been stolen, the solvency of the agencies was guaranteed by the tax-paying animals in the United States. When you read the article, you may wonder at the cleverness of scoundrels who can make $30 million disappear overnight and loot a single agency of $540 million by making loans to pals who intend never to repay them. Individuals so talented might have been useful to in really high finance for the international scale if they had prudently arranged to have their depressions concealed. See, this has been going on. It goes on forever. Go back through history. This robbing the public has been going on forever. And they don't go to jail. They don't get swung by the neck until dead. They just have fun. What is clear is the debacle has been foreseen, if not planned, by the thieves whom the dim-witted taxpayers elect to form the Congress of the United States. A politician, as Mencken observed, confessed that he is a liar, a thief, and a scoundrel, but his racket demands a certain animal shrewdness in addition to the talent to tell nonsense convincingly to the gullible majority of the voters. This requires an intelligence which must have perceived the consequence of freeing savings and loan agencies from regulation, while making the taxpayers guarantee their solvency. Not even the most fatuous uncle would tell his favorite nephew, quote, go have fun, I will honor all the checks you write on my account, unquote. That, in effect, is precisely what Congress made the taxpayers promise. Congressional complicity is further demonstrated by the efforts of senators to prevent inquiry into the affairs of obviously bankrupt associations. Whether the senators received remuneration in the famous brown paper bags that some, when thoroughly soused at lunch, forget and leave at the table, or merely followed the political rule asinium fricate is uncertain. The world's beasts of burden will be taxed $285 trillion. $285 billion to pay for the fun of the heads of the associations that have thus far become bankrupt. And the authors of the article estimate that each individual taxpayer will have to contribute at least $1,000. But after all, why not? The stupid creatures have long consented to be taxed for foreign aid and to provide prosperity for the kikes in Israel and for boss niggers in developing countries, and nothing can be more certain than creatures so low in intelligence that they would consent to being taxed for foreign aid to anyone have become a species of mammal that is no longer viable. There is therefore nothing scandalous or immoral about the looting of the savings and loan associations. If the American imbeciles are willing to give part of their incomes for foreign aid, they certainly cannot logically object to financing the hijinks of Jews and other spoilers in the United States, where the money was spent. Even the most perceptive writers on the subject of savings and loan associations seem to treat the matter as unprecedented and unconnected with anything in the past. They do not see that what's happened to the savings and loan associations was also determined in 1932. We are entitled to assume that the future of the United States has been planned, at least in general outline, in the fateful year 1913, when the Congress, at the behest of the Sheenies, dispatched from Germany for that purpose, and in return for bribes they are said to have been absurdly small in comparison with what was sold, violated the Constitution to subject the American people to the owners of the Federal Reserve, for which preparation was made by the communist device of the income tax. An obvious first step was the First World War, which was not only inflicted death and destruction and bankruptcy on the Aryan nations of Europe and established the Bolsheviks in Russia, but in the United States killed many young Aryans, forced both federal and state governments to contract enormous debts to the usurers, and perhaps most important of all, deformed our social structure and demoralized American society. That war was followed by the blind American reaction, which was speedily contained and reversed by the simple device of precipitating the so-called economic depression, and thus electing a government of traitors headed by our great war criminal in 1932. By that time, the future of savings and loan associations was already determined because of the local associations were then eminently safe investments for persons who were content with a modest but secure return on their capital. It was necessary to convert the Americans from saving and investing to spending and borrowing from the usurers. At one time, New Deal propaganda even claimed that it was unpatriotic to save money. That was hoarding and delaying recovery from the Depression. It was everyone's duty to spend everything he had. Led by venal politicians and dim-witted dupes, federal, states, and local governments borrowed and squandered immense sums ostensibly to prime the pump or construct improvements that were spendthrift luxuries when financed by debt, but actually for the purpose of sabotaging and demoralizing the nation's economy and taxing everyone to pay even more interest to the usurers or imaginary loans, in a progression of which the only possible end will be bankruptcy of an impoverished nation and its stupid inhabitants. That is how, by design and crafty deceit, Americans were converted into a nation of borrowers and spenders, as Mr. Bladen said in 21 March 88, were converted, in other words, to a feckless horde of imbecile spendthrifts. Well, I think that's about it for today, boys and girls. I'm gonna be reading a lot more of these especially the Revlo P. Oliver articles, because he was a genius, and he was an Aryan genius, and he didn't fall into all the traps of conservatism, republicanism, democracyism, and all that kind of crap. And he said it just the way he meant it. When he called the Jews Sheenies and all that stuff, and Congoys were the niggers and all that kind of stuff. So, anyhow, I think I'll continue tomorrow to read the rest of this article. I read about half of it today. But if you can lay your hands on, in fact, I think we've got Liberty Bell magazines up on the website, and you should download them. and because of excellent, excellent material. If you absorb all that stuff in those Liberty Bell magazines, and specifically Revlo P. Oliver's works, you can debate anybody under the table, bar none, on race, economics, or anything else. Okay, that's 14:05, and I'll be back tomorrow on, I'll be back on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, save your money, because there's something coming down, and it's an economic crash or downturn. Many of the best experts in the world are saying February, later this month, or sometime this summer. I know that most of the time they're wrong on these predictions, but watching all these bubbles begin to burst around the world, and what the banks are pulling in Europe and England and Germany and all over the place, can't go on very long. Can't go on very long. 14:05.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.